All right, now welcome to Pro 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 651. Jason Lindgren is with me, and Paul Yates joins us for the first time. We're going to be covering basically the brain drain. At the top of the notes I'm looking at, it refers to it as the great brain robbery. Why are we so stupid? Anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a fine and warm good morning.
Indeed it is, although I'm finally getting rain, which is a good thing. But anyhow, welcome, Paul. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
All right. Why don't you offer where people can find your books or websites, whatever you'd like to lay down?
Okay. Well, Amazon is the place for the physical books. That includes audiobooks as well. Audible, I think they're called. But there's another platform that I use called Gumroad, which they carry all the ebooks, the audiobooks, and it's just better for people that don't like Amazon. So yeah, that's pretty much where we're at with the getting hold of things. The website for the first three books is all concerned with burying debt, imaginary debt, and that's www.debt-ninjas.com. And basically, it's just how to get out of debt using contract law. And then with what we're about to talk about, I'm building a new platform now that, I mean, we'll get into it later, but that's www.redepta.com, which is redepta.com. And if you know your Latin, you'll know that redepta means to reclaim that which was lost.
Good word to use, I would say. But anyhow, give us your backstory. How did you realize what was going on here?
Okay, so we need to go back to the first book, which was probably 5-6 years ago. The name of it is, the title is unimportant, and it's basically because it's contents that matter, as you'd imagine. When the COVID imposition arrived, I realized that there would soon be a lot of people that were in a lot of trouble financially, as well as other ways. And for 20 years or so, I'd been using credit cards and never paying them back. And when the bank came at me or the debt collectors, I wrote them legal letters based in contract law, because backing up again, I'm so interesting that when I was a professional musician on tour buses for 9 hours, I used to read contract law, which is it's not very rock and roll, but there it is. So I've got a good grounding, the legal aspects of finance and contract law. So yeah, I wrote the first book very quickly because it needed to get out there, because a lot of people were about to get into trouble. So that's the backstory on how I got into this. And at the same time, I also wrote the same information, but in a novel with a character-driven story. It's a pretty good story, but it introduces all the legal structures and the framework for what I'd been doing for 20 years quite successfully. It introduced it in a sort of high-level, very simplistic way. And those two books generated a big Facebook group, private Facebook group, which is just a thriving bed of real savvy people that are using the process, and they're helping other people with their process. And I'm so proud of the website or the user group. It's so good. And lovely people, real people getting real results.
And growing. It's getting big, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's growing quick. And it's good because I don't have to be there. Because everybody that's involved in the group is a genuine helpful person, because of the filter questions that I put to get into it are very tight. So there's no bankers in there. There's a couple of lawyers in there, and it's just real people doing real work. So yeah, it's a real good place to be.
As a side note, when you were sending your legal responses to like debt collection, or when they're trying to get you to pay off your credit card, did you ever get pushback, or did they just accept what you did as, this is the law, we got to do it?
Yeah, you get pushback. They have to, because nobody will fold when there's money at stake. So what they do is they write threatening letters, and it's just all saber rattling. They have no legal authority or any standing in the matter. And occasionally they will get it into a court, but you can tear it apart pretty quickly based in contract law. It's not difficult. You just need to, I mean, it's biblical, isn't it? The biggest takeaway for me from reading the Bible was know thyself. Once you know who you are, you know who you aren't. And it carries weight.
Well said. Yeah.
So yeah, that's where I was up to with all of that. But during the process of writing those three books, I was being tapped on the shoulder And it sort of raised a question, which was, I mean, it came at me like a neon sign, and it was, why don't we know this? Why is this whole section of human life in the Western world only reserved for people with money that can access higher-level college? Why don't we know it, the people that really need it? That's been gnawing at me for quite a while, a couple of years at least. And it obviously opened the doors to, well, what else don't we know? So I've sort of been on a mission. Whilst I've been doing other things and writing other things, this has constantly been on the back burner, tapping away at me. What about this? Have a look at that. Is that really true? All this stuff. And it sort of came to a point where I'm thinking, well, this is a huge section of our education that is entirely missing, and it needs replacing before it gets lost entirely. And that's what prompted the writing and research for this book, The Great Brain Robbery. Did you get the reference to the title, The Great Brain Robbery?
Yes.
Ronnie Biggs.
Actually, the first time I said it, I said train instead of brain.
Exactly. Yeah.
Force of habit.
Yeah, exactly.
So getting into the actual bullet points you've got here, we're not getting dumber by chance. It's strategic, which I completely and utterly agree with. And I'm assuming that's a reference to how they laid down the groundwork for the masses to receive an education or lack thereof.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, I can give you an example here. When I got my first checkbook, I think I was 18. I was no longer in school. And I realized I didn't know how to write a check.
Yeah.
No one had ever shown me how to write a check. And I mean, I wonder how many other, I mean, do you remember your first checkbook? Did you know what to do with it?
I did, because my mother taught me.
Ah, there you go. Good parents. Anyhow.
Yeah.
So we're not getting dumber by chance. It's strategic. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Once I realized that this couldn't be by accident, people get better at things, not worse. That's just human nature. The more you do something, the better you get. But we were actually going backwards. And it's, you know, if you've lived long enough, you can see it in your own lifetime. So I started looking for the evidence. And one of the first things that I came across was, have you heard of the Flynn effect?
Don't believe I have.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's a measure of IQ over time throughout the population. And in the 1990s, they posted their latest stats, which shows that it's reversing. That's statistics, and it's kind of irrefutable. So, yeah, the Flynn effect reversal has been going on since the 1990s, which, I mean, we know, we feel it, we see it. You know, if you've been around a few years, you can see that people aren't as sharp as when we were kids.
No, the young generation now is so many of the basic things that my generation knew in grade school, how to read a clock, how to read cursive writing, even anything to do with geography. I've noticed that the idea of geography, many young people can't list three countries, nor the country that they're actually in, these kinds of things. And that it's kind of astonishing that we've gotten to this point.
Mm. Yeah, it is. I mean, all the statistics that I started pulling out, I mean, things from OECD and Stanford and Pew, they've actually documented that there's been a widespread drop in critical thinking, literacy, attention, all of it. It's documented. It's not imaginary. And so what I did was I found out how that's come about, what the process has been. And it went right back to sort of 1706. And it's been sort of incremental and gradual. What does David Icke call it? Totalitarian tiptoe. And it's there. You can see it in history. And it's scattered. But you can pull a timeline together. I have pulled a timeline together.
I think you meant 1760, not 1706, right? You're talking about the revolution.
You would not believe how many dates I've got in my mind. I don't even remember my own birthday. But that's only alleged anyway, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, we've got all this evidence. And because of my background in the law stuff and everything, I mean, I did veer for a short time into being sort of conspiracy theorist motivated and all the rest of it. But I have to say, a massive part of my now working on evidential facts rather than imaginary or conspiracy stuff is down to your show, because it's powerful. What you guys do is powerful, and it's evidential.
How did what we were doing affect what you were doing specifically?
It just reinforced the importance of having evidence, the same as a courtroom. You know, when I used to go into courtrooms, if you go in with nothing, you are nothing, and you'll lose every time. And it's the same. It's the same with writing a book. You know, if you write a lot of nonsense that's unprovable and unfounded, then the book's worthless. So I've always sort of maintained that the evidence is your standing, and if you don't have any, you don't have any. So there's no point doing anything. So it's crucial. It's the critical foundation of what you're doing. And once you've got that in place, then you're away. You can go wherever it takes you.
It's a big help because it takes the nebulosity out of everything.
Yeah.
For sure. But let's get into school here, Jason.
So what we're doing here is we're taking it back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and the powers that had all the money and the influence were setting things up to work against the masses, basically. And that brings us to where the education system isn't broken. It's functioning perfectly for its true purpose.
Yeah, it's not serving our interests, even nearly. It's failing us, but it's working beautifully for the people that need it to work well. And that's why we're in the position we're in right now, because of the education system. I mean, I speak to homeschoolers quite a lot, and they think they're on the right path. But they aren't, because they're just teaching the same Prussian education, but at home. So these children aren't getting the power of having their mind opened and all the synapses functioning and firing so that they're sharp and they've got cognition. It's not happening. So the homeschoolers, sorry, but if you're teaching Prussian education system, you're just giving them the same thing, but in a lunchbox.
Well, you are helping them from a social standpoint because they're not necessarily getting bombarded with all the crazy leftist stuff that goes on in school.
Sure. But that's a double-edged sword as well, because then they don't learn how to interact with others.
Well, ideally, you're not doing it in a vacuum. You're doing it with a homeschooling group. Yeah. When I was doing it, I did it with some other children for my daughter to interact with.
Didn't you have to deal with the state showing that you were doing some curriculum or another?
So Louisiana is actually really good about that, but every state is different. I had to file just that I was doing it, and they pretty much left me alone after that. But that's not true with every state.
Same in England. There's apparently moves afoot in Parliament to standardize home educators.
Which just means more of the same.
You know, you couldn't make this up, could you?
Oh, man.
So that brings us to why logic, rhetoric, and grammar were removed from the mainstream curriculum.
Yeah. Yeah. What they want is they want conditioned, conformist, compliant docility, basically. They want
obedient workers, button pushers.
Yeah. Yeah. They want workers that have got enough intellect and cognizance to be able to do the job well, but not much else, because they need workers to fabricate the world that the other guys want to live in.
A big part of it is memorization and regurgitation, which is not learning. But what I came to realize along the way, when you start to bring up things that were components of the classical education, the education that I had beyond the memory and regurgitation, what it does is it labels things and it separates things. Nothing really, for the most part, is connected. In a real world, everything is connected. And in what Jason and I have done here, the biggest example of that is vibration and the idea of cymatics and color. And you begin to realize that what we call reality, which isn't really that, but what we call reality is common in every way to everything else. And I think that's one of the big breakdowns in the school, is that they have taken anything that's truth-based in nature and turned it into an artificial idea with a label.
Yeah, because it separates.
Yep.
It separates us from the source,
which is truth.
Yeah. There's a book I read years ago called The Magnetic Universe. Have you heard of that?
I have, actually.
Yeah. Basically, what it conveys in there is that we are living in a field, not a meadow, an electric field, a soup. We're in there. We're immersed in there. And nothing is disconnected from anything else. It's a symbiotic circle, as it were. And the purpose of the education system is to break our discovery and understanding of that on a very, very basic level. And a lot of people go to their graves never realizing that that's the truth of the matter. That's how they live. That's where they live. They think that the system is the way of the world. And it's just one aspect of the world. But it's so pervasive. It's endemic. It covers everybody. But obviously, as we'll get onto shortly, the classicists aren't subject to the same mind redaction that the rest of us are. And, you know, you only need to look at a politician anywhere in any country. They don't live in the same world that we do. They don't think the same. They don't operate the same. And they don't understand our world and we don't understand their world. But it's very much an us and them situation. Pink Floyd nailed it right at the start.
Well, they know it too. You could look at anything from royalty to Rhodes Scholars, and what they're being given from the ground up is far, far different from what the average person is getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
The difference kind of being taught how to get along within a system, but being told nothing about how the system works.
Yeah, well, the jailer's never going to hand you the keys, is he?
No, not willingly.
Which actually brings us to the next point that you have here, which is how we replaced wisdom with test scores, the rise of credentialism over deep knowledge and understanding. And I would also suggest that part of that came much later in the 1960s when they started smashing the families up.
Yeah. The problem with families, as it was then, was that they were microcosms. And it extends slightly beyond the family, because the way that children learned was initially from the parents, then the grandparents, and then it spread wider to the other guys in the village or the tribe or clan, whatever. And the community all came together and, okay, they all understood that this kid belonged to those parents. But there was no, so we're not going to do that because we want our kids to be dominant or whatever. It was a case of all the kids were instructed by all of the community. And that had to be broken if this system was to succeed.
Well, the big thing that they started doing, taking the wisdom away, was warehousing the old people instead of having them be readily available and taking part in the raising of the next generations.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a sequestering away of wisdom, basically, because these guys have lived long, mostly healthy lives without the nonsense that the old people of modern era are tolerating, sometimes not. But these guys had all the knowledge. So, you know, tribal elders aren't just fantasy. The reason they were tribal elders is because they had all the wisdom, which was handed to them from their elders and their communities. And that needed breaking if they wanted to change the way that humans live in the West.
Well, that fed culture as well, which meant the culture was real and applicable to wherever they were. And look at us now. We regularly say our culture is we like some TV shows and watch some movies. But there are examples to me, in my mind, that demonstrate the loss you're pointing out. We had it. When you look at things like the cathedrals, they had all the classical ideas that were allowing things like that to be built. And most people now think those are churches. Those were healing centers, among other things. But the buildings were functional, absolutely functional. Even the windows are demonstrating a cymatic pattern, which is a vibration, which we've already talked about, connects everything. And even if you go to what are considered third world countries, you can go where Buddhist monks are being trained. And guess what? They're still, at the very beginning, a novice monk is taught logic, rhetoric, and debate.
Yep.
And that's a throwback to the classic education that you are working to revive.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'll just stick a point in there about the cathedrals. I'll go further than you just did and say that these places were power stations, and that's why you'll always find them next to water. And I suspect it's in the book. I've looked at a lot of cemeteries as part of the research, and I can't find a gravestone before mid-1800s. And I think that the gravestones and the cemetery is a distraction. I think it's an infilled pond that which used to be full of water for the earthing discharge for the power station.
Yeah, those buildings were absolutely functional. They were absolutely built on sacred giant geometry. And what the average person doesn't consider is that any logo, shape, geometry, it has an energy. So when we say something was built with sacred geometry, someone who recognizes the energy can produce things like those cathedrals that are functional, literally functional, even to the point where the organs, one of the things they did is they healed your internal organs. How do you think the organ got its name? From my point of view, there's the connection.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same with the bells as well. Right. They destroyed, the line was that they had to melt down all the railings around the church and the bells for bullet casings and bullets in the war. And I think that's an absolute ruse. I think what really, really was going on is bells and the tolling of a bell was frequency. And I think it, as far as it could be heard, I think it had healing effects for the village.
Yep.
And that had to go as well.
We know this by the tuning.
Yeah.
There are very few old world bells. Jason and I just did an episode on one of the occasions when the bells were stripped from the world by the hundreds of thousands. It's astonishing. You can still find pictures, but this is spot on. And you know what we're talking about begins to speak to what was an average lifespan. You know, in this country, we were taught, well, the cowboys and Indians ran this place way back, and you're lucky if you saw 40. You know, this is what's been banged into our head.
Yeah.
You got to wonder what our lifespan was back in the time where those cathedrals were active.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's more questions thrown up once you open the door of perception in terms of what really were these buildings and how the hell did they build them? Because they certainly didn't have the, or allegedly, they didn't have the machinery that we have in modern times, and we still couldn't build them now. But what were these buildings? How were they built? And who were they built by? That's a big question for me. Who the hell built these things?
Right. You'll be told the church, like Notre Dame, the church claims it, but they can't tell you the architect. I would suggest to anyone who wants to listen that there's ample evidence from the windows and the cymatic patterns they represent, from the vibratory frequencies that we know were healing people in there, to include the organs and the bells, that they knew how to manipulate frequencies and vibrations much better. If that is true, it is possible that they were levitating stones, which was being done in, of all places, Tibet, up until the 1800s. I think the last Westerner to actually witness this and actually videoed it or took a reel of it, which was taken away and hidden. So I think it's quite possible that stuff was moved with the very technology they were using in those edifices.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a modern researcher. He's got it probably been taken down now, but I saw quite a few years ago on YouTube when it was in its infancy. I think he was called Stanley Clough, or his last name was definitely Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H. He'd built a lab in his basement with a sound chamber, and he was levitating huge stones, and I think he even did an anvil.
Yeah,
and he was doing it with a great big speaker built into the floor, and it was just toning. That's all that was happening. He was just altering the tone, and this thing was levitating at different levels depending on the frequency. And he also showed if you hit it with its resonant frequency, it actually disintegrated in the chamber. So there's a lot going on there, and this has been removed from knowledge, from circulation, for very good reason.
These are the keys that relate to a classic education, like the trivium and the quadrivium, because in those classic education styles, they take you back to what is color, what are shapes, what, you know, all these things in a mind being taught that at a young age, you can put it together. I mean, it's quite likely people are marveling at the stones that look like they were turned into Play-Doh. It's quite likely that resonant frequencies allowed them to move it, shape it, change the consistency. And these are the types of things that when they get re-recognized, they're absolutely going to change the world.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm actually right. I've been writing, probably it's going to be my magnum opus. All of these questions, a lot of them have answers, but they're in their infancy at the moment. I mean, things like, for instance, the Great Pyramid or any of the pyramids, there's been continual debate. How did they build them? The stones aren't from that area. The structures that they would have had to build to actually put the stones up there and all this stuff. Once you've opened your mind with the trivium and quadrivium, you actually know how to think about things again, if you ever did before, but certainly again in terms of species. And I realized a couple of years ago now that the pyramids were not built as we've been told. They weren't stones that were shifted around. There's a new, relatively new process called geopolymers. Have you heard of that one?
I have. Yep.
Yeah. So the pyramids were poured. Simple as that. They were poured on site. I can't find an argument against that, but I can find plenty of arguments against the shifting 100-ton blocks around. That's just not feasible at all.
Well, to me, the pyramids, as amazing as they are, they're not the apex of the demonstration that kind of shows where apparently we once were and are now. It's the temples in India and some of them in Africa, carved out of a single piece of stone, intricate at levels. We've got ones that were dedicated to sound, where pillars that look identical resonate at different frequencies. These massive pillars rotate. And even if none of that was true and it was just the single stone and the detail of the apparent carving, how? We can't even start to put our heads around it most of the time. And the polymer idea, a lot of people I've seen, well, a few people I've seen applying it to what goes on in places like Machu Picchu.
Yeah, I heard a theory about the, well, it's not a theory, about the, on the slopes of Machu Picchu, there are seashells. And I think Machu Picchu once was an entirely different elevation to where it is now. And I think it was probably coastal. And through sort of geo upheavals, I think it got pushed to the point where it is now. All of this stuff you can only start thinking about once your mind's working properly again. And this has been the path that whoever it is, I mean, I've named and shamed quite a lot of the guys in the book that have been instrumental, the movers and shakers in all of this. If they hadn't have done what they'd done, we'd now be in a much more advanced place and we'd be doing the same kind of things, you know, that, you know, if somebody just popped up now and started doing that, it would almost be witchcraft magic in terms of the scientific world trying to rationalize what's going on, because they have very definitely been led down a path. I mean, most of physics doesn't work anyway. If you study physics, then you're in the box, so it works to you. But if you look at it as an outsider, there's always the why question that comes up. So yeah, I mean, we can't really rationalize as we once did when we were capable of building these structures, if it was us that built them.
Well, I'll take that a step further. It's my point of view that the entirety of the digital infrastructure that now operates the world was intentionally built for two reasons: to lead us away from the things that the quadrivium and the trivium teach, which are related to truth and the natural environment, and to create the artificial control systems they wanted, which brings us up to the next point, Jason.
You're not anxious or distracted by accident. Digital overstimulation, processed food, and environmental toxins work together to fog the brain. Now, this is what I used to call the YouTube generation, but I've had to amend that to the TikTok generation.
Clock is ticking.
None of this is accidental, is it? Let's face it. It's just too precise, too well laid out to be accidental.
And too artificial.
Yeah.
And artificial is the separation between that which is true and that which attempts to metaphorize or mimic truth, a knockoff.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in the most basic forms, you can see the problem if you choose to think about it. If we have a book, it's a little bit of work. You got to pick it up. You got to turn the pages. And yeah, I want to know a lot of things, so I need a lot of different books. But guess what? The information that was put there was worked on mostly a lot harder to be put there, but it's going to be there in 100 years. A web page, a button push changes the content, and it's a cheap knockoff is what it is. And it brings convenience. And I've started to equate convenience with slavery. It seems like every convenience that we accept puts us a little further under the chains.
Yeah. The situation is getting to a point where most people can see it now. Even with a heavily redacted understanding of the world, the artificial injected sort of reasoning that we've been left with. Even those guys can start to see it now.
So that brings us to the next point, which with all of the antsiness that people feel these days, Big Pharma has stepped in and we have this insane mass medication of the mind, a culture that is chemically managed into docility, and especially with the children with this ADHD and all the other things that they like to slap labels on.
I don't know about you, but I'm suffering from restless leg syndrome right now.
Oh, I can fix that instantly.
I bet. I just saw a statistic that claimed 80% of the world's pharmaceuticals are consumed in this country.
Wow. Yeah. If you've got restless leg, tie a sock around your foot. Seriously. It blew my mind.
There's been recent sitcoms not too long ago that made fun of it for people who are working in pharmacists, said things like, well, we both invented and cured rapid eye syndrome today.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got to laugh, haven't you? You've got to laugh.
So after the TikTok generation gets blasted out with drugs, we now have the IQ conundrum. Why global intelligence is falling despite more quote-unquote education than ever before. And that's pretty much it. It seems like people are just so blasted out from so many directions. What are we going to have in the next few years?
Blank page, I think, if it carries on. I mean, if you project it outwards from where we are now, we're going to have the sort of the thousand-yard stare in everybody. The fluoridated eyes. George Orwell talked about this plenty.
Rollerball. Remember the old movie Rollerball from back in the day where they were doing a version of Brave New World and a couple of those? Everyone's on a drug, everyone's under corporate control, and everybody's slightly dimwitted because they're meant to do what they're meant to do and nothing else.
And they're obsessed with the sports ball.
Right.
Ball.
Yeah, there you go. In court. But if you consider how the infrastructure that we use today has been dumbed down, like when Twitter came out, well, you can use 125 characters, but you can't express a full idea. Then, you know, YouTube comes out. Well, TikTok overtakes that. And what's that? It's shorts. Everything's been diced down to this rapid fire, what's next mindset.
Yeah. None of it accidental. None of it whatsoever. I mean, it's just so handy for the system, isn't it? That everybody's getting so, well, apathetic, really. I think that's the order of the day. There's just so much apathy in everybody. And, you know, it's like a 20-second soundbite, and it's even quicker to forget it because you're on to the next and on to the next and on to the next. And, you know, ask somebody what the first one was, and I bet nobody can remember.
Consume content, get excited for next piece of content.
Yeah.
Which needs to be more shocking.
Yeah, nobody retains any of the content. It's like channel skipping, you know. You don't ever get involved or invested in the content. It's just next, 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 next. It's crazy.
Well, the content shifts too because it becomes boring. So shock value or something is constantly added on. And the film industry is a good idea of this right now. When's the last time anyone saw a modern movie that was a story driven movie? I mean, those are almost as rare as unicorns now.
Yeah.
Which also leads us to the next point again, cognitive warfare, how institutions shape our thinking without consent. We have surveillance capitalism, media narratives, and soft censorship, and sometimes not so soft, right?
And sometimes self-censorship.
Well, that's the ultimate destination for all of this. Make us self-limiting, self-restricting, for no other reason than fear of what could happen. I think the bravery's been sucked out of the population now. I don't think anybody really wants to stretch themselves or put themselves into any kind of discomfort. And, you know, as we know, the only time you grow is through discomfort and difficulty. And by that metric, nobody's growing now because they're just so comfortable in that little environment. And they can't think past the first post on the fence to realize that there's a world out there still. And it's a crazy situation. Nobody wants to stick their neck out, which makes the guys that do almost godlike. You know, this is why everybody reveres the billionaires and the tech giants and all the movers and shakers that have actually done what everybody used to do 100 years ago. So, yeah, we've been so restricted by all of this. It's like there's no desire, there's no ambition left anymore.
It's true. And masculinity has been on the decline. And in some places, it's looked down on. If anything masculine pops up, that's part of the gender thing going on. But my buddy just told me this morning that Jimmy Kimmel got himself kicked off the air or something like that, suspended for making a joke, which we all know that free speech is protected and the line is drawn at injury. You can insult people. I don't even know if it's true. I was just told that. But what I was getting to is what that leads to is a thing we see all the time now where people will talk about a gun, but they'll say pew, pew, self-censoring their own language because of the platform they're on. They won't say the word dead. They'll say unalive. They'll do any number of things to avoid saying the word, which is ridiculous on the face of it, because the algorithm can figure out what you're saying, even if you put up little icons to get it done. And this is training people to self-censor.
Yeah. The thing that you just said about the self-censor and they're changing the language. They're actually, they're redacting the language down, which ties back into the removal of Latin, which it's probably the most, Latin and Arabic are probably the most expressive, fully formed languages that have ever been. Thankfully, Arabic's still around and still used, but Latin is just, it's allegedly a dead language, but go to the Vatican and the cash machines in Latin.
Sounds like they know something.
Well, scientists, it was never dead. They're still naming things using Latin.
Yeah.
But this language shift and what you're pointing at, what it does is it breaks the bridge to the past. You can no longer take language to get somewhere, to learn something from before when that bridge is broken. To take a prefix or a suffix or a root of a word, that gets destroyed when online abbreviations or other things do away with that portion of language. And Latin, when I was young, the people who were my adults were still learning Greek, Latin, French, or Spanish in school. I had a 70-year-old friend when I was in my 30s, spoke Spanish, Greek, Latin. Of course, he had a Catholic education, but that is very rare now.
Well, it's not rare in the
aristocracy.
Yeah, it's not rare there. They still get the full benefits of a classical education. But the rest of us, I mean, when was the last time you spoke to somebody that could actually speak English?
Well, good point.
It's full of slang. And like you say, with the pew-pew word instead of gun. I mean, that's not even a word. But, you know, everybody understands what it means. And there's an argument that says, well, as long as you understand each other, that's all that matters. But that's not all that matters.
No,
because
it's not.
The precision of language is what creates great things. And you take the precision from language away, it seriously compromises any ability to create great things. I mean, if you want to be an engineer, you learn German because that's the language of engineering. You want to be a poet, you learn French or Italian. And this is the thing. If you learn Latin, it covers all of that.
All right. So that brings us up to the myth of progress. Why more tech does not equate to more wisdom. The illusion of knowledge versus true comprehension. I think that is excellently put.
I mean, if you look at architecture alone, we begin to see the problem that we have dwelled on so many times. I recently saw an old kind of golden age movie with Gary Cooper doing The Fountainhead. Have you ever seen The Fountainhead, Paul, or read the book?
No, don't know that.
So the movie The Fountainhead, I'd seen it before, but I appreciated it at a new level, having recently seen it, and it addresses what we're getting at here. In the storyline, it's an Ayn Rand book, by the way, which she's been turned into a political football for the right recently. But the Ayn Rand book, there is an architect who refuses to do what everyone is requiring to succeed in architecture, which is put Greek columns on everything. So he's producing these, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright-like things, and no one will accept him, but he refuses to bow to the progress. And that's the storyline of the thing. But when we come out in the real world, you know, when I go to my state capitol here in Rhode Island, here's this building. It's kind of mind-boggling. It looks just like every other capitol building with a Romanesque dome on top or whatever it is. But then when you drive away, all you see are the angles of sorrow, boxes and rectangles.
Yeah, that's what they're turning the world into now, boxes and rectangles.
Even the fast food restaurants, they're all just generic looking boxes these days.
Yeah, yeah. And anybody knows, as Ian Gillan would say, any fool knows that flat roofs are not good design. But yeah, all the fast food restaurants have got flat roofs now. And it's because they're not designed to be there for very long.
Well, they don't want you there for very long. They want you to get in, spend your money, and get the heck out.
Yeah, no, I mean, the building's not meant to be there for very long.
That too, for sure.
There's a big section in the book about architecture and modern building. And I was absolutely scared witless to learn that modern construction, housing especially, is only designed to last for 50 years. And you think, wait a minute. So the guy that takes the huge mortgage to buy the house, he's buying into a guaranteed loss, because when the building falls apart because of the inferior materials that it's made with, it's going to be worthless in 50 years. And not only will he have lost all of his investment, but he also has to pay for its demolition, because some of those materials are hazardous and can't go in landfill. They've got to be specifically disposed of. So that's the situation now with these modern boxes that they're selling as houses. It's just absolute lunacy. But it also points to maybe they're not planning for these buildings to be around in 50 years. Anyway, so it asks the question, what's going to be happening before these houses become due?
It's really quite astonishing. There are numbers of YouTube videos where builders are just going through these multi-hundred-thousand-dollar house builds and showing just how cheap and rickety it is. It's astonishing that it's come to this. Yeah.
This is where the sick building syndrome comes from, because the materials make you ill.
I'm like one of the last of the Mohicans here, you know, a house built in the 60s. And it's so funny because every time something needs to be repaired, the people who come in always comment, oh, that's when 2x4s were really 2x4. You know, that's when this wood was actually, you know, they comment on it. Even the plumbing, it's crazy to think. We're going to have a do-over at some point if we get through this, because there's so many things that will need to be just done over.
Well, it goes back to the original question that we started with. How can we be doing this and suddenly we get the knowledge that this is actually dangerous, bad for us, non-sustainable, non-profitable, all the rest of it? How have we got so stupid that we are doing this? It's my big question. How have we got that idiotic?
I have a two-pronged theory that seeks to answer that very query. And it goes like this. Part of it is what we're covering, that basically what we tend to call social engineering. The very wealthy taking control and implementing their control where they can. The second part is, how are we so stupid to accept this in the first place? I think that as I film the sun, I am looking at the answer to that. I think we're on cycles. I think that the old Vedic traditions were onto something when they had the idea of a dark age versus a golden age and the things in between. They even relate it to a thing I've discovered kind of recently, which I suspect is a second sun. And in their model, when that other body gets further away from us, we get dumb and we go to sleep. When it gets closer, we wake back up and our consciousness expands. And that's the angle that I'm working on right now.
Yeah. I think further than that, I think there's a system at work that is doing its level best to prevent our, because we're obviously in a rising consciousness phase right now. And I think that this system is doing its best to prevent us from attaining that. And it's doing pretty well so far.
I agree. It's done pretty well invisibly. It's no longer invisible. So that's the big change. And that's, in my mind, were the questions about reset.
Yeah.
You know, you and I talked a little while we weren't recording. Is a reset a function of them recognizing the consciousness shifting upward and trying to deal with that? Is the reset something else altogether?
I think it's when the whole world gets to such a level of cognitive awareness, their system fails. And I think that's what brings about a reset.
Which is also tying into your next point here, as we come up on the end of the hour here, who benefits from a population that can't think straight? Who's profiting from stupidity? Well, the controllers are, of course, because if you can think for yourself, you'll realize that the game is rigged.
Well, in the modern world, we have a single word that kind of defines that: corporation.
Yeah.
That's who benefits.
Yeah, always. There was a, see if I can remember it. There was a quote I came across when I was writing the first three books. I can't remember the lead up to it, but the punchline was, but the bank always wins. And it's never been more true than these days. It doesn't matter what you do, the system always wins.
Because they've got something in place to deal with every situation at this point. They've had enough time to put in enough roadblocks for everything that it doesn't matter what you do. They've got something to get you.
Yeah. Until we all come together, and then it becomes critical mass.
Well, this is what the race card, the gender card, the Charlie Kirk card, these are the ever ramping, ever more shocking events that are strategically put forward to increase division. And the problem we have now is the control over the communication system. Is it an accurate view that so many people gave them the reaction they were going for? Or is the real view that they're cherry picking the ones that are out there and making it appear like the majority of people are reacting in the way they have designed?
I think they wanted both sides, didn't they? I think they want, like you say, they want that division. They wanted the conspiracy theorists to put in their two penneth, and they wanted the straight guys that believe in media to have their reaction. And then they wanted the left and right guys to start with each other. I think the whole thing was just division in action.
Well, sure, each one of those is like stirring the pot. They're going to feed off of each other.
This is one of the reasons, Jason, I quit covering these things. The last time we really covered it, and we didn't want to at the time, was Mandalay Bay. That's when the response to that was deleting the YouTube channel and putting an algorithm on Google products that censors my name. But at the time, we saw so many people falling backwards, having come through Sandy Hook, thinking we'd actually made progress. But it's a catch-22. It is an absolute catch-22, because the act of trying to readdress it is just echoing that virility into the world. Even with you have the best intentions, even we'll stipulate that everything is said is correct that you're trying to bring up. Nonetheless, you are re-echoing that plan into the world. You're putting a megaphone on a strategy that is working against us all.
Yeah. I mean, I've long ago stopped watching media, the mass media, mainstream. But I mean, it still filters through, because you get it in Facebook feeds. I get it in the business on the Debt Ninjas group. There's often posts there. So you can't really avoid it. And I've sort of come to the conclusion, just non-reaction is always the best policy. You know, okay, this happened, that happened. How do I feel about that? Well, does it really matter? Next. You know, I've almost used the TikTok mentality for mainstream media and all the news. And it's just a case of, yeah, whatever. If it's on the mainstream, then it's obviously planned and to drive a reaction from as many factions as possible. So yeah, just non-reaction is how I look at things these days.
That's actually a lot of how I implement things. You can ask Jason. It's just, it gets to a point where we speak and we say things as if there is a intelligent audience ready to receive that. And the truth is, there's not an intelligent audience. There are intelligent individuals, but there is a massive audience. And so just to leave it alone is often the best way to go. But we are at the top of the first hour here, Paul. Can you tell folks one more time where they can find your work?
Amazon, P. Michael Yates. There's about 11 books there now. So, and Gumroad, P. Michael Yates again.
All right. We'll get the links in everywhere when this goes up. Jason, you want to add anything before I wrap up hour one?
Do you want to give a taste of what we're going to talk about in hour two there, Paul?
Yeah. Pretty much everything I write, I don't write it as commentary. I write it with a solution in mind. And I don't really like to set off on any project if I don't have something to offer as a resolution. So that's pretty much what we'll get into, the resolution to getting back on track with our mental faculty.
There you go. All right. Well, this has been hour one of episode 651. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crrow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and they get exclusive access to the following: all of the solar work that I'm doing with my 130 millimeter hydrogen alpha telescope. That's exclusive to members. The movie Shoot the Moon is also exclusive to members. That covers all my past solar work, to include the 2015 discovery of the so-called second sun. Also on the website are solar stills that people requested to print. If you do get them and print them and hang them, please send us an image. The 19th member solar video is now live on the website for members, and also for new members. You guys get new solar images when you sub. That wraps up hour one, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.